is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll get a look at the changes made to the streets of downtown San Luis Obispo.
We've been doing this for almost a year now. We've built out more than 30 temporary parklets throughout downtown and even a few outside of the city. And the reaction in general has been really positive.
Also, you'll learn about the business of making hard cider from locally sourced fruit.
There's specific varieties of apples that you can't get in the store, but make a very good cider.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, it's June 21st, 2021. I'm Carol Tangeman. Since 1992, the San Luis Obispo Legal Assistance Foundation has provided services and resources to people in need in San Luis Obispo County. On today's nonprofit story, your host, Dr. Consuelo Mukes, is speaking with the foundation's Stephanie Barkley about the work they do and how the SLO Legal Assistance Foundation was able to help local renters, landlords, and homeowners during the pandemic.
You have a couple of new programs and grants. Tell us about those.
Sure. Well, we've been really lucky over the last year and a half to be able to grow because of some new grants that we received. And we do want to help try to get the word out to as many SLO County residents as possible who might need our help. The first grant that we got, it's called the Sergeant Shriver Civil Counsel Act grant, and it's through the California Judicial Council. And the purpose of the Shriver grant is to improve court access, to increase court efficiency, and improve the quality of justice. Our services have expanded. We're not just helping seniors anymore. Through this grant, we are able to help anyone with an income at or below 200% of the federal poverty level. They would be eligible for our services. And it's a partnership grant with the San Luis Obispo Superior Court, aimed at providing a range of free legal services for people in the areas of landlord-tenant law, conservatorships, guardianships, and elder abuse. There are only 10 legal aid organizations in California who received the Shriver grant, and SLO LAF is one of them. So we're very fortunate to have this opportunity with the court in our state. And we are actually the first Shriver elder abuse project in the state. So wow, that's exciting as well. And you probably remember we've always done some landlord, tenant, and elder abuse work, but this grant's going to allow us to take more cases, expand our staff capacity, and also expand our services to the areas of conservatorships and guardianships, which we had not previously offered.
That's fabulous. And I think it helped you to bring on some new staff.
Right. It allowed us to hire two new attorneys and a paralegal, and then the court was able to hire a self-help attorney in the areas of housing and conservatorships and guardianships to help. And they're also able to hire a housing settlement conference master who is going to attempt to mediate all eviction cases before they go to trial.
So that's one, and that's huge right there. And we do want to get back to it, but I think you have another one, also a landlord-tenant clinic.
Yeah. Now this grant we received from the California State Bar Association, and it's also a partnership grant with the Superior Court, and it's allowing us to run a landlord-tenant self-help clinic at the courthouse. The clinic's already opened and running. We're not at the courthouse yet until they reopen to the public. It's currently operating out of our office by appointment only. And we are located on South Higuera by the DMV. So that clinic offers free help to landlords and tenants. They just have to be considered indigent as defined by the California State Legislature, and they need to not be represented by an attorney. So these are self-represented litigants who are trying to kind of navigate the eviction process on their own and need help with the paperwork. The clinic coordinator will not provide legal advice or representation, but will help with, you know, filling out the forms, identifying the correct forms that need to be completed, helping with the unlawful detainer complaints and answers, helping with e-filing, proofs of service, getting security deposits back, that sort of thing.
Okay. And then a third one that you got, legal help for foreclosure prevention. Those are for homeowners. Is that correct?
Yes. Homeowners who are at risk of foreclosure. We have this grant. It's another partnership grant, but this is with another legal aid organization, Legal Aid Foundation of Santa Barbara County.
Oh.
And we can provide free legal help to homeowners who are either in default on their mortgage or having trouble making their mortgage payments, need help with loan modifications, forbearance, that sort of thing. We can help with that as well.
That's a lot. You have taken on a whole lot and very quickly, so you're busy. Let's jump back to the Shriver grant that you talked about, Stephanie, this huge grant here for landlord and tenant services. And give us some more idea about that. Is that just because of this COVID-19 situation that it's in place, or is it something that's going to be permanently available?
It's going to be permanently available, and we actually applied for it before COVID. There was already a need for help in this area in our county because it was just our office and CRLA who were providing free legal help. And there were a lot more tenants mostly who needed free legal assistance than we had the capacity to provide. So we applied for the grant before COVID. We were thrilled, you know, we found out during COVID that we were going to be awarded the grant. So it was a really good timing.
Mm-hmm. So with this legal services now and the landlord and tenant services, tell us exactly what it is that people could come in and get assistance for from you.
So we're providing a different, like a wide range of legal services, kind of depending on a lot of things, including the person's ability to self-represent, whether there's a lawyer on the other side or not, the strength of the person's case. But we can provide services ranging from some legal advice and information and assistance with self-representation to full scope representation, depending on the need and the situation. There may be tenants who start the process on their own or get help from our clinic and need a little bit of help, don't need full representation, but maybe need some strategy advice going into mediation or trial prep help or help with the particular issues. So in some cases, we may be helping in a limited way. And in other cases, we'll be taking the case and doing full representation.
So what type
and
of
we'll
case-
be helping with all sorts of landlord and tenant disputes. Mm-hmm. Eviction is high priority, but we also take cases related to habitability, fair housing, reasonable, you know, disabilities, reasonable accommodations, wrongful evictions.
Mm-hmm. So anything that the tenant and landlord are having a dispute with, you can assist with that. The other part of this you mentioned had to do with elder abuse services.
Yes, we do elder abuse restraining orders for the most part. Yep.
Okay. Is that a new service that you're offering or something that Slow Law has done before?
We have been doing elder abuse for many years, but this grant is allowing us to take more of those cases.
Which elders would be eligible to work with you?
So under this grant, they would need to be 65 or older and within 200% of the federal poverty level. So lower income and a senior and the victim of abuse.
So they could just call your office or someone can help report to you and then you would go out and check up on the person?
Actually, that's where we differ from adult protective services. We are not law enforcement, so we have to have a client who understands what they need and wants our help. So the senior who's being abused would need to have capacity and be able to communicate with us what they want. We do sometimes get calls from, you know, a helpful family member or neighbor, and we are not law enforcement, so we can't go investigate allegations of elder abuse. But adult protective services and law enforcement can and do that. So they're the agencies to call if you are just concerned about somebody and you want to make like an anonymous report of suspected elder abuse.
Okay, thank you. This is the Nonprofit Story. If you are just joining us, I'm Dr. Consuelo Mukes. I'm interviewing attorney Stephanie Barclay, who is the legal director of San Luis Obispo Legal Assistance Foundation. Stephanie, also, you have a tenant clinic self-help program, which is interesting. Is this for people who you said have already started the legal process, but and they want to do it themselves without hiring an attorney?
Well, sometimes that's what they want, or perhaps they would like to have an attorney, but we are at capacity, maybe not taking clients, or for whatever reason, there's a conflict of interest or some other reason why we don't take their case. They can still get help from the clinic with getting their paperwork filed, and they would not have an attorney represent them, but they can represent themselves in court and we'll help them get the paperwork done. Sometimes because of the short time frame for evictions, if a tenant gets served with a summons and complaint for an unlawful detainer, they only have 5 days to get an answer on file. And sometimes they won't call us until the day that it's due. So this is a quicker way that they could get help in that sort of situation if it's like a last minute thing. Most litigants dealing with evictions are self-represented. If there's an attorney on the other side, a landlord is represented by an attorney, then that's going to be a priority for us in terms of providing representation if we can. There's a number of factors that go into our decision as to who we can provide. This is assuming there are more cases than we can handle. Mm-hmm. We'd love to be able to just give everybody representation, but the funding is such that that's not usually possible because there are just more people eligible in need than legal aid is able to represent. So we have to kind of triage and figure out who gets what level of services, and hopefully everybody gets, you know, some services so that they at least understand and know their rights and how to advocate for themselves if we can't provide an attorney for them every step of the way.
This sounds like the faster someone gets in touch with you, the better.
Absolutely, yes.
This other area that you can work with now on free legal help for foreclosure prevention, tell us a little bit about how that works with homeowners.
It's pretty broad in terms of how we can help under that grant. So that one as well, like don't wait until you get a foreclosure notice. If you can't make your mortgage payments, or if you've got a notice of default, contact us for help, please. The sooner the better. If the foreclosure's already happened, we don't take wrongful foreclosure cases. And I don't know of any legal aid organization to refer them to. So at that point, we can only help with, you know, the possible just giving advice and helping try to find housing. So sooner the better on those as well.
In our time that we have left, I'm wondering, is there anything that you could share about the help you can provide due to the COVID-19 situations, people that maybe have not been able to make their rents or having other issues? Are there any special programs going on or information people should know that can help them with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as you can imagine, over the last year, that's what most of the calls have been about, COVID-related evictions and COVID-related non-payment of rent. And everybody's wondering right now whether SB 91 is going to get extended. And unfortunately, I wish I had the answer to that question. That would make people feel a lot more comforted if they knew, but we don't know yet. We don't know what the state's going to do.
Can you just give us a little bit about what SB 91 is?
SB 91 extended it's what people are calling the eviction moratorium. That's not exactly an eviction moratorium, but it extended the temporary eviction halt that was signed into law back in August. It also established the COVID rental assistance program. Mm-hmm. So it extended just cause protections to all tenants, regardless of the types of tenancy, so that no tenant in California can be evicted before July 1st based on a no-cause eviction. There are some evictions that are currently allowed and happening, but it put a halt to a lot of evictions, and it put a halt to non-payment of rent evictions when the non-payment was a COVID-related hardship. Mm-hmm. And there's a number of things that the tenant needs to do to protect themselves under this COVID Protection Act. Probably don't have time to go into all of them today, but just for tenants to be aware that these protections aren't automatic, and that if you have any questions, to call us about what you need to do to make sure that you're protected. And we don't know whether it's going to be extended or not. As long as they've done what was necessary up until July 30th, these tenants who have COVID-related hardships, then they can never be evicted for that non-payment during that time, as long as they've taken the steps that they need to, which include paying up to 25% of your rent that was in arrears. And the deadline to do that is by June 30th. So if you're a tenant who hasn't been paying rent for a COVID-related reason, remember to pay 25% of the rent and utilities that's in arrears by June 30th to keep those protections in place.
There's so
it's confusing. I know.
Well, it's there, and there's a lot of information, and I wish we had more time that we could hear it. Perhaps I'll need to have you back to talk about that a little bit more, and especially after you find out what happens with SB 91, which would be
yes, that would be good. And also on our website, we have FAQs in English and Spanish about the about COVID evictions. And also a Zoom recorded presentation we did on this topic. It's like an hour long, and it kind of talks about all the specifics related to SB 91. So people could watch that if they want to go to our website, www.slolaf.org.
Attorney Barkley, we want to thank you for coming on the program this afternoon with this really important information.
Thank you so much, Consuelo.
Yes, and this is Dr. Consuelo Mewkes. We have talked with attorney Stephanie Barkley, the legal director of Slo Legal Assistance Foundation. Thank you for joining us today on The Nonprofit Story.
On today's episode of Around Downtown, we'll get a close-up look at some changes in San Luis Obispo streets, partly due to the pandemic. We'll hear from Luke Schwartz, transportation manager of San Luis Obispo, about the possibility of some of these changes becoming permanent.
For KCBX Issues and Ideas, this is Bettina Swigger, and this week we are going to be talking about shared streets in downtown spaces. In addition to your friendly radio host, I also have the pleasure of being the CEO of Downtown Slo, which is the placemaking organization that serves San Luis Obispo. And I'm going to be having a conversation today with Luke Schwartz, who is the transportation manager for the city of San Luis Obispo. Thanks so much for being with me today, Luke.
Yeah, nice to talk to you, Bettina.
So Luke, tell me a little bit about your background. How did you get into city planning and transportation management specifically?
Sure. So it all started when I was attending Cal Poly as an undergraduate, just studying civil engineering here in SLO many years ago, it seems at this point. But I always was interested in transportation. I loved riding trains and buses and walking around and driving different places. That love just grew and grew as I started getting opportunities to learn more about transportation engineering as a potential career path. And I followed that up in working in the private consulting industry in the Bay Area as a transportation engineer, and worked in the Bay Area, other parts of California, all across the country, in areas like New Mexico and Albuquerque, just working on different types of transportation projects. The things I enjoyed the most were things that involved multiple modes of transportation and projects that have like a placemaking or streetscape element to bring streets alive from just serving as utilitarian infrastructure to move cars and people to infrastructure that could really add value to communities as well. So I worked in the private sector for about 10 or 12 years. And then I've been at the city of San Luis Obispo being in the government side for the past 5 years in our transportation division, getting to do all sorts of really fun and exciting things here in SLO.
And when you say the word transportation, I think we all sort of have a pretty clear cookie cutter definition of what we think that is, but you might have a deeper understanding. So when I hear transportation, I think planes, trains, and automobiles. What is transportation to you?
At its root, it's really getting people or goods or services from point A to point B, but it means a lot to different people. And what really drew me to transportation was it not only just serves a kind of general purpose, but you're involved in people's every day-to-day experiences, commuting to work or to school, or running errands or traveling. Every action that people take in their day-to-day lives involves transportation. It can not only be a efficient and safe activity, but it has an opportunity in many ways to be an enjoyable experience. And when it's not, it can really degrade people's quality of life. You know, every business has supplies and resources that they need. And so a really interesting career in that you could be involved in almost everything in some aspect.
You make some great points about transportation, getting good services and people to where they need to go. Over the course of the pandemic, a lot of people and goods and services were staying put. How have you seen the transportation sector impacted for better or worse by the last 16 months?
It's been really interesting. And as a city, we've had to do a lot of things that kind of create a necessity to be nimble and experiment to address the unique issues that were brought about by the pandemic. But even heading into that, there's been a lot more thought in the transportation planning and engineering industry over the last few decades about what our streets really are and what they can be. For the past 50 to 75 years, the main focus in the U.S. at least has been building, expanding, and maintaining car infrastructure. So moving people in cars, often by themselves, to work, to different places in their communities as quickly and as efficiently as possible without much friction that might slow them down or make those experiences frustrating or add congestion. And it's really, that's been our main focus. In a lot of ways, the way our communities have been built and the way our economy works is built off that. And a lot of it's really positive and has had great outcomes. But like any kind of resource or tool, just like if you're talking about fire or things like that, it has a lot of value and has a lot of great potential. But there's a lot of kind of ancillary impacts associated with focusing so much on making a resource as narrowly focused on one thing, like moving just car traffic. It's important, but the impacts of focusing on that have been torn down existing communities to build new roads. And we've created a lot of other kind of negative impacts by designing every street and every community with one purpose in mind, where different communities and different transportation facilities have different needs. We've been thinking a lot more about how do streets play into the role of community vitality, economic progress and success, and neighborhood quality and just community health. And so there's a lot of ways we're rethinking and revisiting as an industry to be thinking about things like equity, environmental sustainability, community health. And for most cities, just like in San Luis Obispo, our public street right of way is really one of the largest areas of just public land that any city or government agency owns is our streets. And so when you think about that, well, how are we using that space? Is it meeting the needs of everyone? If we overbuild a street, does that mean we have less room for parks or businesses or economic growth? And so we've really been thinking about how much space we assign to one mode or the other and trying to get more of a balance that meets a lot of different priorities than just moving car traffic, which we still, you know, is important. It's not something to be just passed aside, but thinking about other ways we move people and serve our community. One of the main focus areas that's been a growing topic in our industry is how we use curb space. So in most streets, you have one or multiple travel lanes, and then you have shoulders, and that's often used for parking, commercial loading, things like that. But that space can be used for a lot of different things. In some communities, you know, maybe that space is better used for a bike lane, a commercial district like a downtown, maybe having wider sidewalks, areas for street trees, furniture, lighting, landscaping, things that add to the value of walking in some cases might be a better priority for those neighborhoods. And then how people get to and from commercial districts and their day-to-day routines is changing too with the increase in use of ride-hailing services like Uber or Lyft. In some communities, there's programs that have shared transportation resources like shared scooters or bikes or shared cars where there's a single vehicle that multiple people could have an account and access to for short periods. We can't just keep building more and more space. And parking is very expensive to build, particularly if you start looking at garages and structures in the downtown. So we're trying to get more evolved and advanced and creative with how we use our curb space and prioritize that space for different needs in a way that meets evolving technologies and just ways that we do our daily business.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Luke Schwartz, the transportation manager of San Luis Obispo, is speaking with host Bettina Swigger.
Yes, and in downtown, one of the things we like to encourage is for people to explore on foot, right? So one of the things that creates a walkable area is a clean, safe, and interesting walk. And so we've now created, through the pandemic, and the city of San Luis Obispo has been a real pioneer in this, in our region, is putting in these parklets, which is a word that I first learned when I came into this line of work, but now is on everybody's lips. Can you talk a little bit about the parklet installation process and what that felt like last summer and what it might look like going forward?
Sure. And for those that may not know the term, a parklet is basically the repurpose of a street parking space for another use. It often involves some kind of temporary extension of the sidewalk. It could be an area for just general seating and public use. It could be an area that's reserved for specific businesses, like for outdoor dining or a sidewalk cafe. Could be additional space just for queuing at businesses that have like lines that spill out the door. And it really started in the Bay Area several decades ago with an event that was called Parking Day. And it was kind of a test. Hey, we have so much real estate dedicated just to car storage and parking in our cities. Let's take a day where we temporarily convert some of those spaces to little mini parks or outdoor dining or things that people can enjoy outside of the box of their automobile. And it was really taken off. And it's not a new topic. You go to many cities in Europe or even some older cities and big cities in the United States, and you'd see just a lot wider sidewalks, more space dedicated to people and things that people do when they're walking and enjoying a commercial district outside of just being in their car or storing their car as close to a business as possible. So we had been thinking as a city about exploring a parklet program for years. And as we kind of watched what was happening in other communities in the state and kind of waiting to see what worked best, we were thrust upon having to figure this out as this pandemic was really hitting a peak. Most of our restaurants were completely shut down indoors in spring of 2020. And we had some of these businesses that are such a staple of how our community economy works. There's so many people in SLO that are employed in some way or another in our service economy. And when that's shut down, it has a ripple effect. It affects everyone in our community. And it was really, just really sad to see our downtown so quiet and empty because it's such a cultural and economic hub of our city. So we started early on with a program that we called Open SLO that looked at a bunch of strategies with, hey, how can we use our city resources of right of way to add more flexibility for people to distance and expand their businesses outside to keep them open? And we started with some temporary street closures to let businesses just spill out into the street. And what we found, it worked great for some restaurants. We didn't have a real density of restaurants on one or multiple blocks that would allow it to really thrive the way it has in some other cities.
In Santa Barbara, for example.
Santa Barbara is done on State Street for 7 or 8 blocks. And it's, you know, I visited a few times. It's working great. There's other cities that have a similar benefit. And what I've noticed there is, one, they have maybe more of a two-way grid, or at least a more flexible circulation system surrounding the major street, where it didn't have as disruptive an effect just on the traffic circulation. But also where it works really great is if you have a single block or multiple blocks with lots of restaurants or service uses that will be using the space, expanding their tables outside and adding the activity, where if we have one or two restaurants on a block and the rest of the street's completely empty other than people wandering around, it doesn't seem to work as well. And we heard that from some of our non-restaurant retailers. And hey, there's a lot of people out. That's great. They're not necessarily coming and shopping in my business. And so we kind of pivoted early on to strictly start focusing on parklets, which is basically, well, let's not shut the whole street down. Let's dedicate more of our on-street parking, build out these temporary areas that allow restaurants and cafes and businesses that were shut down or limited indoors to operate outdoors and stay in business. At the time, because of the pandemic and the stay-at-home orders, we had very little parking demand downtown. So a lot of the streets were kind of empty anyway. So in starting to convert some of those parking stalls, we weren't really displacing parking demand because it was so down so much at the time. We've been doing this for almost a year now. We've built out more than 30 temporary parklets throughout downtown and even a few outside of the city. And the reaction in general has been really positive from the restaurants. Obviously, it helped them survive. And then some of them even said, well, this is something that we would love to continue with, even when it's not again a triage action during a pandemic. And then as the community too, we have amazing climate in San Luis Obispo. We have a community that loves to be outdoors and don't have a lot of public space in the downtown outside of Mission Plaza, and already have a longer term vision to give more space within the downtown to people. And so the parklets were kind of an early test pilot to see if there is appetite for that. And the response has been generally positive. We're doing a lot of outreach now and thinking about what's the long-term future of this. But in general, having a more vibrant and active pedestrian-oriented downtown is right aligned with all of our goals. And the parklets really seem to complement that.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Luke Schwartz, the transportation manager of San Luis Obispo, is speaking with host Bettina Swigger.
So last week, a survey closed where you're asking the community at large to answer a series of questions about the Open Slow program and specifically focusing on the parklets. What was the response to the survey?
We put out a community survey as we want to know from whether you live in Slow, you visit Slow, or particularly if you're a business owner or representative of a local business, we wanted to know what's working, what's not, is there interest in continuing some of these things in the long term? And if so, what are the things you want us to be thinking about as we might consider some kind of permanent programs? We got over 7,000 responses to the survey, which is insane for a city of our size. A lot of those were local residents, and I think our confidence level based on the statistical sample was like 99% plus. So it's amazing to see that kind of response. And we're still digging through a lot of the data, especially we had several questions that allowed people to kind of type in specific questions or comments outside of just checking a box or an option. So 7,000 plus participants, it's a lot to dig through still, but the major themes are kind of floating to the top already. And what we're seeing is roughly 80%+ of people that want to see parklets continue in some kind of permanent capacity, which is really great to see that there's a really strong majority of the community that likes us. And then there was other topics we're looking at too, whether we should continue adding some kind of flexibility or policies to allow businesses, restaurants and with private parking lots to expand into their own space and open their outside dining more into their parking areas, which is a whole different kind of conversation than the public parklets that are in the public right of way. But so far, the response and the support is really strong. We're obviously getting to a lot of input on what are the things that we should really focus on tweaking or thinking about closely as we continue. Obviously, people are concerned about parking supply and want to make sure that they can get to downtown and be able to park as conveniently as they reasonably can. And, you know, everyone wants to go and park right in front of the business they're planning to go to. It doesn't always work that way. And it's a finite resource that's in high demand. And so we try to balance the needs of making it efficient for people to get into the downtown by car if they need to, and if that's their preferred option, but also balancing that with still maintaining a really walkable downtown, encouraging people to walk or bike or take transit when they can so that we're using that limited space as efficiently as possible. So far, the responses from the surveys are really strong, and I think will be really helpful as we plan to return to our city council in July to get some direction from them on how they would like us to proceed. And having that really hard data from the community saying what's working, what's not, what they want to see from our community is really helpful.
It's interesting you brought up the fact that the parklets are displacing parking spaces for vehicles. And we also have a lot of people who use bicycles to access our downtown. So a couple of things that came up that I'm thinking of, there is now a bike plaza where you can park your bike. Bike Slow County has a parklet in front of the Slow Chamber at the intersection of Monterey and Morrow. And are there any other exciting bike developments that are going to increase access by bike to the downtown?
Sure. As a city, we've adopted goals for how we ideally would like to see the share of trips within the city by different transportation modes. And while we still plan to accommodate car traffic, especially as an employment hub, a lot of people drive into the city and don't have a lot of other options. But particularly downtown, we want it to be really safe and accessible for people walking and biking. And as part of this Open Slow program, we wanted to be cognizant of that too. We saw a lot more people in our communities out walking around, biking around their communities because they were stuck at home and had limited options to get outside and be active. Bike sales were way up. Most of the bike shops in town had long waits and couldn't keep up with their customer demand. So that was part of our thinking in this too. And one thing we did as a pilot project, we temporarily restriped Higueras Street in downtown from 3 lanes to 2 to add a bike lane. And part of that was to slow illegal speeding too, with less traffic on the streets and less parking. We saw people driving faster through downtown, which was, that's not something we want to encourage. It really detracts from safety and kind of enjoyability of being downtown. So we tightened up the street, added more buffer from our parklets, and they also added a bike lane, which take pride in being a bicycle friendly community. And we've won awards and designations nationally for being that, but our main street, the kind of heart of our downtown, it was not bike friendly at all. So we added a bike lane. We also have been incorporating bike parking where we can into some of our parklets. And for a few years, we've had a couple of bike corrals downtown, which dedicated about a parking stall length towards bike parking. And just simple geometry, we can fit about 10 bikes in a single car space in general. And so there's interest and people are, we have demand, you know, we can just accommodate a lot more people in our downtown if we have bike parking. And the bike plaza you mentioned on Monterey Street was a fun activity too. And that we, some of the temporary changes we made to a block of Monterey Street right near Mission Plaza, where we had some restaurants that were really benefiting from being able to expand into the street area, we ended up with kind of an island of space that we couldn't really use for anything else in front of the Chamber of Commerce near Morrow Street. And so we talked to the Chamber in downtown SLO and Bike SLO County and said, well, is there a way we can kind of creatively activate this space? And there was interest in doing something with some public art, maybe some street murals, and additionally providing some additional bike parking areas that could maybe be used as a bike valet for future events when the farmers market or when the concerts in the plaza return. So all through volunteer help and some of the city resources that we had budgeted for our Open SLO program, we had volunteers out there painting some street murals, installing some bike racks. I've seen out there a local, like I think it was a high school jazz band set up for an impromptu music session, which is really cool to see. And we put in some benches and planters, and a big shout out to Bike SLO County and especially Gary Havas, who dedicated a lot of hours and his own craftsman skills to make this a reality. And I'm really hoping that depending on how we move forward and what the council and community want to do, that we have find a way to preserve that space, because I can only see even more fun ways that we can activate it.
Well, thank you so much, Luke. Really appreciate you taking the time to explain how transportation works and what has changed and what's going to change next. My biggest takeaway from our conversation is I don't really tend to think about our streets as public space. And that's a really profound lesson for us all to ponder. So thank you very much.
Yeah, anytime. Thanks, Bettina.
This is Bettina Swigger for Issues and Ideas. I've been speaking with Luke Schwartz, the transportation manager for the city of San Luis Obispo. Thank you so much for joining me here for this month's segment called Around Downtown.
It's time for Working Lunch, a Facebook Live program from the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce. Today, you'll learn about Two Broads Cider Works.
Welcome to Working Lunch, the SLO Chamber's weekly series where we connect with community leaders who are doing exciting things in our community. I'm Jim D'Antona, President and CEO of the SLO Chamber, and today we'll be having a conversation with the founders of Two Broads Cider Works, Maggie Prabilski and Morgan Murphy. Since 2017, Maggie and Morgan have been turning local and heirloom fruit into distinct ciders that go far beyond those you may have seen in a Super Bowl commercial. In early 2020, they began to transform their warehouse into a tasting room, patio, and production area. With COVID bearing down, they switched to direct-to-customer sales, ran a successful Kickstarter campaign, and turned to community assistance programs and small business grants. They hope to open the doors later this summer. I'm so looking forward to talking with them about their journey to opening the Cider Works, learning more about the Central Coast cider scene, and all they are doing to provide an inclusive space for community to gather, especially those that identify as LGBTQ+. Morgan and Maggie, thank you so much for being here.
Hi. Hello. Thanks for having us.
What are some of the basics of cider? Can you maybe share the non-scientific version of how it's made, Maggie, and maybe what makes it special?
So it is apple juice. We get the apples, we crush them into juice, and we ferment them. And it's really very similar to wine. The brewing process has a lot more heat involved, and the winemaking process does not. And our license is under the wine license. So really, it's a lot like wine. Mm-hmm. And as far as apples are concerned, a lot of times ciders are made with blends of apples, but they can also be made with single varietal apples, like wine.
Morgan, what initially interested you about cider and fermentation? Were you always a hobbyist, or was there something special about cider that caught your attention?
We started out as hobbyists. So we started out actually making beer, homebrewing. Cider caught our eye in the fall. We used to travel, not very far, but to Sea Canyon. There's a lot of heirloom orchards back there. That was our first experience of like heirloom fruit and how it could be, you know, really interesting and different than, you know, your standard store-bought apples. And we started fermenting some of the juice to make cider. Is what got us initially interested. And then I think traveling. So we traveled to Spain, France, and England and kind of got introduced to their traditional ciders, which is where we fell more in love with cider in general as like a thing that would be fun to introduce here on the Central Coast.
As you learn more and kind of tinker with the process, what pushed you to cross to home brewing, to starting your own brand? Did you have a plan, a strategy, or was it kind of just more jump into the deep end?
We always wanted to work for ourselves. And I think as we saw the hobby grow and we started to get more awards for the beer that we were making, that we kind of thought going professional was the next step. And so we tend to do a lot of research before we jump into anything. Sometimes the research will slow you down a lot, but at the same time, you're also more prepared for what's ahead.
We did a lot of research and probably started approaching analysis paralysis, and we decided to finally start the business. We were like, okay, there's just things we don't know, and we just got to try because we'll regret it if we don't.
For someone who has maybe only had a big brand cider, how would you describe the difference between that and maybe your ciders?
I would say that cider is a much more inconsistent thing than people expect. In fact, throughout the beverage world, when you get into a large business, what's the Budweiser? Let's take Budweiser and Angry Orchard and like big brand of whiskey. They're very consistent. They're making a lot of product. So they can spend a little bit less money because they've had that upfront cost taken care of. And so they spend a little less because they can get it in bulk. We are at a scale where we can't really do that. So we can't buy in bulk. And we do have to be pretty opportunistic about where we're getting our apples. Mm. The crop does change every year, just like with wine. So when people come into our cider works expecting to see the same cider all the time, well, they're just not. But that's great for us because it keeps everything interesting. You'll find something different and new and exciting, and you'll learn more about it that way too.
Morgan, you're in the sweet spot to produce some really interesting ciders and show a large range. Can you share a little bit about how you approach collecting and sourcing apples that form the base of your ciders?
Yeah, I think firstly, we try and stay local. So we're looking at local orchards around us in the county, maybe down in Ojai, that kind of area. But we try to keep it local. Apples, it's a lot like if you think about wine grapes. So you have your red grapes, your white grapes, and then you have your table grapes. And so you wouldn't make a wine necessarily out of table grapes, but you might select a grape that has a lot of tannin or a lot of acid. And apples are very similar. So there's specific varieties of apples that you can't get in the store, but make a very good cider. So we're looking for those kind of apples. We're trying to balance like acidity and sugar for what ultimately becomes the alcohol, and then like that tannin quality that you might get in a red wine. Most of our cider kind of drinks more like a white wine, but we do have some that have a lot more tannin and structure, and they're kind of these big, robust ciders that they definitely break your preconceptions about what cider should taste like.
Maggie, talk us a little bit about what types of apples maybe grow best here on the Central Coast. You said a little bit about heirloom, I think, in Sea Canyon. Is our region known for that in particular, or anything in particular?
The history of Sea Canyon is actually really cool. There was a Civil War veteran who settled in the area and brought a whole bunch of apples. He planted the first orchards over there, and a lot of those trees survived and then were repropagated. I mean, it kind of depends on the microclimate, but generally, apples need this thing called chill hours. And that means when they go dormant, they like to have a certain amount of time where they are below 40 degrees.
Chill hours are actually really interesting, especially for apples. What is described on the label of the apple, if an apple had a label, isn't always true. So historically, you know, you wouldn't grow a certain variety of apple in Avila Beach, you know, or Sea Canyon, because it's right next to the coast. It doesn't get that cold in the winter. And so that chilling kind of puts the tree into dormancy, and then it wakes up in the spring. And there's sort of this biological component where it's kind of triggered to wake up and go to sleep. There is some interesting research going on in all places, Irvine, where they have no chilling hours, and they're planting a lot of these like high chill varieties that should have no business being planted there. And they're actually being very successful. So I think apples could be a lot more successful here than maybe some people have preconceived notions about. Yeah,
we just have to try them. Mm-hmm. But in general, a lot of culinary and dessert fruit is grown in the area, and we absolutely want to support those farms. So we do buy that fruit, even though we get really, really stoked if there's some heirloom variety like Arkansas Black or Bellflower or Gravenstein.
Mm-hmm. Kingston Black, Yarlington Mill. There's all kinds of really interesting apples that we're excited about. So.
Really interesting to hear that you may actually be able to challenge some of those and get some different things growing in different areas. I'm one of those people who get really nerdily into apple varieties. Is there one in particular that you guys either love or are dying to try?
I really want to work more with crab apples. I mean, we've had Transcendent Crab and Dolgo Crab that we can get locally that we've been able to play with. Mm-hmm. And while they don't make a very balanced cider, we still love it. It's very acidic and it's very tannic, but it's just got these full, big, beautiful flavors. And then I think the other ones that we want to start enjoying are red fleshed apples.
Yeah, they're just sort of coming on the scene, but you know, you cut it open into an apple, it's usually white or kind of a yellowy cream color. These apples have red flesh and they're just super stunning. They make brilliant red juice and they make really robust ciders, and they kick out a ton of really interesting like blackberry aromas and red berry fruit notes. So they're just super interesting.
This is listener-supported public radio, KCBX. Maggie Probilski and Morgan Murphy of Two Broad Cider Works are speaking with the Chamber's Jim D'Antona.
Maybe if you, Morgan, if you could talk a little bit about how the local cider scene has changed since you first began.
I would say it's grown a lot. It's actually surprising to think about how many cideries we have on the Central Coast now that maybe you haven't heard of. And you've got the bigger ones who've been around for a while. So you've got Tin City up in Paso, Bristol's in the Atascadero. I think Bristol's was the first one. They're trying to echo England because Bristol, England is actually a great cider region, the West Country, as they call it. But it's still very tight-knit. Everybody's very helpful. Like, we were just out of cider share across the street with Slow Cider, with a bunch of cider makers.
Mm-hmm. And Gopher Glen.
Just sharing our cider and nerding out about it. So it's still very tight-knit.
You and Slow Cider are in the same, like, parking lot, right?
Yeah, we can wave.
Yeah, initially, like, they moved in and I was like, oh, man, this is going to be, what is this? But we're actually really excited because we're sort of creating a destination for cider. You know, you come to our cul-de-sac and you've got two ciders, and there's another operator down the street who is kind of starting up. So we're trying to like name our neighborhood, like, you know, the Cider Circle or something. I think it's a cool little aspect. We're going to be a little destination.
I think it's a great idea. I mean, you look at the wineries that go into like Tin City, they build that power for each other. That is super exciting. Maggie, how would you describe your brand and products to someone you just met? Is there a kind of theme, a characteristic that runs through your ciders other than the amazing labels that are so cool?
We generally like a dry style. We let our cider go all the way to the end without stopping it. A lot of people will stop the cider to make it sweet. We'll stop the yeast from working, but we generally like the balance a little bit more tart. It makes cider really food friendly. We think that cider and food pairing is a fabulous thing to introduce people to. And that's generally what we make, but we are so excited about different styles of cider that we just want to try to make everything. We're doing something not a lot of people do, and that's an ice cider. Ice cider is the only regulated cider in the US We can't really call ours an ice cider because we don't have a natural freeze here, but we do freeze our juice into cubes in order to make an ice style cider. And that's the only sweet cider we make. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like a dessert wine. It's about 16%, which is pretty high for a cider. And it just has a ton of acid, ton of residual sugar. And it's like something you would sip for dessert. And it's just amazing.
By putting it into the ice, or is it somehow concentrating it?
Yeah, so water thaws before the juice. And so as you have this big, you know, you can think of a big juice tote of cider that's frozen into a solid block and you're thawing it over several days. And as it thaws, the concentrated sugars and flavors and acids come off first because the water is staying behind as like a big ice cube. And so you're kind of drawing the water out of it, but you're getting all of the flavor. And if you know anything about wine, it would end up at like 28 to 30 bricks of your starting gravity, which is really high. And so as it ferments, the yeast eventually can't ferment it anymore. It just gives up because there's too much alcohol. And so you're left with a really sweet, but highly acidic, highly flavorful cider.
How fun. In addition to the science side and all the great work you're doing to create the juice and the beverage, it seems like you put a lot of creativity into your work. Where do you look for inspirations for things like naming your ciders? I know some of the great names I've seen, you know, Kumquat May and Bearded Queen, and an homage to one of my favorite movies, The Princess Bride. With
We do a lot of pop culture references. Kumquat May is actually a nod at Moulin Rouge, the love ballad at the end. Come what may. And then like musicals, like I Feel Pretty is from West Side Story.
I guess there is a musical theme, which, you know, we weren't starting out for, but it just sort of happened.
Musicals and movies.
Bearded Queen was actually, so some friends of ours run drag shows here in town, and one of them is a bearded drag queen, and he likes IPAs, and that was a hop cider. So we kind of named it for him. It's just a fun name. Some people it's sort of like you give a man a purse and they kind of hold it out here. And they're like, I don't know what to do with this, but it's for the brave. Be brave. Drink Bearded Queen. It's fine. It won't kill you.
That is so fun. You have these pop culture references.
This is listener-supported public radio, KCBX. Maggie Probilski and Morgan Murphy of Two Broad Cider Works are speaking with the Chamber's Jim D'Antona.
Beyond just your customers, you've built strong relationships with other businesses in the Central Coast community. Can you share a few that maybe you're excited about right now, Maggie?
Yeah, so we have been working with Park 1039 to do a cider and charcuterie and cheese pairing. We also work with Good Tides Bistro to pair some of her delicious pastries with a cider. And one week we offer the brunch pairing and the other week we offer the picnic. And then we also use the proceeds from those sales to support local charities. Like we're supporting Race Matters Slow this month with the sales from those.
And I mentioned that you're looking forward to opening your new tasting room and to greeting an inclusive space, especially for those that identify as LGBTQIA+. Can you tell us a little bit about how you approach other parts of your business, including maybe the art and your labels, in a way that also supports the LGBTQ community?
Yeah. So these labels, we have two queer women who we buy art from for our labels. Sybil Lamb is out of Montreal, and we liked her book work. She wrote a book, and she also writes comic books and does book covers. And then Dorian's a friend of ours, and she's up in Oakland. And she does some really, really fun art too.
We're looking to showcase different artists, from either women artists or LGBT artists. Eventually it'll evolve into local artists that we can support.
Yeah.
But it's just a fun way to kind of connect with our community.
Do you taste a cider like you taste wine, or is it kind of like, no, just drink it?
I always want people to pour a cider into every beverage should be poured into a glass. We don't go crazy, but just drink it, enjoy it. But you should try and notice, what are you smelling? What are the aromas? Because that's kind of what gets us excited about it, is all the different flavors that are coming out. So
yeah, I'd say for, as in like a the judging piece. Like if you were going to go to a contest and start judging cider, I'd say that you can kind of treat it like a wine, swish it around in your mouth, spit it out. Generally though, if you go to like a beer contest, they encourage you to swallow the whole thing because of the way that changes the flavor all the way down your throat. The full experience is going to be taking that full sip rather than spitting it out like you would at maybe a wine judging.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to notice a lot more flavor if you put a cider into something like a wine glass. So that's kind of the other thing about our tasting room is we are going to have nice glassware. You know, it's not going to be a jar or something like that. We put a lot of work into it and we want you to enjoy it at its best. So that's kind of our approach.
Well, Maggie, when you look to the future, what do you hope Two Broad Cider Work looks like and is doing in the next year?
Well, hopefully this tasting room will be open. We've kind of put a lot of stuff on our plate this year because we've also recently signed a lease for an orchard in San Luis Obispo. Kind of a lot going on for us in 2021, learning how to run an orchard and opening a tasting room at the same time. I'm not stressed out about it at all.
Is that one of those where if you say it, you'll believe it eventually?
I'm trying to.
We're very stressed out about it.
One day at a time, right?
We'd always wanted an orchard because it is hard to find the cider-specific variety. So if we can grow those ourselves, you know, that gets us ahead of the game. The opportunity presented itself at completely the wrong time, but we couldn't turn it down. So we're going to make it work.
We're really excited for you both and looking forward to what this brings for our community. And thank you so much for both of you joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, it's great talking to you.
Maggie Probilski and Morgan Murphy of Two Broad Cider Works and the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce's Jim D'Antona. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.